We've been talking about time travel today, and I have to confess, I've never been a huge fan of the whole paradoxes of time theme that's so popular in science fiction. But I do love historical fiction, which I guess is a kind of time travel, especially when it's based on true events and real people, like Alison Richman's latest novel, The Velvet Hours, which was inspired by a recent newspaper story in the Paris Press.
A good friend of mine read this article online about a mysterious Parisian apartment that once belonged to an elusive courtesan by the name of Martha de Florian. And the granddaughter of Martha de Florian closed this apartment just before the Germans came into Paris during World War II and never returned to it, yet paid the maintenance on it until her death in 2010. You know, as soon as I read this story that my friend sent me with the lines, "You need to write this as a novel," my mind began spinning with all sorts of questions. You know, who was Martha de Florian? What was her relationship with her granddaughter? And why did Solange close the apartment, keeping it as a shrine to her grandmother?
So Alison couldn't stop thinking about this mysterious apartment, and she wound up trying to find out more.
The facts were pretty sparse. We do know that Martha de Florian wasn't born with that name. She was born with the name Mathilde Beauguiron. So we know that she changed her name, that her mother was a laundress, and that she herself, before becoming a kept woman in this sensual apartment, was a seamstress. And her heirs discovered on the last will and testament that there was this apartment in the 9th arrondissement, Paris. And when it was opened, this beautiful, sumptuous apartment was covered in a veil of dust. And above the marble mantel was a portrait of their great-grandmother, painted by the very famous 19th century painter Giovanni Boldini, who was a contemporary of John Singer Sargent. Love letters from the artist were found in Martha de Florian's vanity, tied with satin ribbon, and other paramours, but specifically him. And so that plays a part in the novel as well.
What did the apartment look like when it was first opened? Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it because when I actually went to start researching the novel, the apartment had already been sold and the contents as well. I did work with a historian who tried to contact the auctioneer who handled the selling of the painting and the contents, specifically because I was interested to see if I could read the letters that Boldini had written Martha de Florian.
These but love letters.
The love letters, because I was really curious, was it a mutual, you know, infatuation?
Was she in love with the artist, or was he just in love with her?
Exactly. I mean, before I started writing, and I wanted to understand the facts. But my historian was told that the love letters were burned by the heirs of the estate. Now, I personally don't believe that's true. I actually think that was an answer to sort of just end anyone trying to investigate any more of the story, probably because they were being pestered by so many different people to find out. I mean, everyone was sort of interested in this.
I mean, how could you burn your great-grandmother's letters?
But it's the only way to shut up a writer in New York who really wants to read those letters.
Right.
So, you know, I received that information with a bit of disappointment, but at the same time, as a novelist, it enables you to say, well, I tried to do my due diligence, and now I'm going to imagine what happened.
And Martha de Florian, she was a courtesan, a kept woman. Mm-hmm. Explain what that was at that period of time.
Well, she was almost like the way we imagine a geisha, someone with very cultivated taste and elegance and who really takes great pleasure in the different layers of seduction. I think that's really something that's different than when we think of a prostitute who's just trying to make money by selling her body. This is more an experience of beauty, pleasure, elegance. And researching the novel, I was really taken to how there were sorts of all rituals of just pre-seduction, you know, the different types of baths you take. You take one steeped in lime blossom. You take a cold one to make your skin firm. You know, you used powders that were made out of crushed pearl in order to increase iridescence on your skin. You'd use rose oil not just for dewiness and to increase the pink circulation so you looked sort of like a newly picked flower, but that the smell, the aromatherapy of it. So of all my novels, this was the most fun to research because it really showed a side of feminine beauty that I wasn't familiar about, especially being a busy mom. It's really, I can get ready in 10 minutes. Believe me, there's no lime blossom and there's certainly no rose oil.
But it's the portrait of a woman who made herself into a work of art.
Exactly. And that's a really, really wonderful way to put it. Yeah, she literally cast off the shadow of Montmartre of being literally a daughter of a laundress.
And to extend the metaphor further, her lover, the man who gave her this apartment, set her up in it, furnished it, gave her an income, he was her collector. He was an art collector. And
exactly.
she was an item in his collection.
Exactly. And he visited her on his own schedule. So she's hidden. I mean, there's that poem too, the de Florian poem that he brings her about to be happy to remain happily hidden.
You know, from a contemporary feminist sensibility, I mean, this seems reprehensible. She's just this object who's kept by this man
for his pleasure,
caged for his pleasure while he has another life and a wife and a family that she can never meet. There's a whole politics of this that is fairly...
There is. And I think, but if you look at it from the fact of how financially savvy she is in this situation, she does carve out her own form of independence. I mean, you could never put our feelings of feminism on a character like Marta de Florian or any woman at that time, I think, because, there was no women's rights at that period. Mm-hmm. A courtesan had more rights than a married woman, for sure. Certainly a middle-class, or upper-middle-class woman.
You have a background in art, and there are art objects, sort of scattered throughout the novel. It makes it somehow very tactile to read about. But I wonder about, for you, if there are backstories or deeper symbolism behind some of these things. For instance, there's a magnificent set of pearls given to Marta by her lover when he knows that he's dying, and he gives her this, if she sells them, that'll be enough money to live on for the rest of her life. Any particular inspiration for those pearls?
Well, for the pearls, there is an inspiration. About 5 years ago, my grandmother, who actually just passed away a few months ago, gave me a set of pearls and told me that the pearls had belonged to the love of her life and that it wasn't my grandfather, and that she wanted me to know the story about the pearls before she passed away. And I was really surprised to hear this, because, of course, as a granddaughter, you expect that your grandmother's love of her life is the grandfather that you always knew.
I mean, how did you feel about that?
Well, how did I feel, honestly, Anne? I was shocked. But my grandfather was a very hard man, and my grandmother was a very soft woman. So in some way, it made sense that she had thought about this person her whole married life, probably, and that she still kept these pearls. So I now wear them a lot, and I always think about the fact that every person's life has these secrets that so many people don't know about, and that in a lifetime, probably people have more than one love, and that love is typically kept private to them, but only they know the story unless they're willing to share it at the end of their life. But truly, I mean, jewelry is one of the few things we wear on our body that almost always contains a story. It's either given to us to commemorate something. It could be an heirloom that connects us with someone that we love from the past. We might buy it ourselves to commemorate a certain accomplishment. But typically, it has a story, and really, that's what makes it so valuable.
It's funny. One of the things I love, the thing that I just keep coming back to, I know it's not a character, but it's that apartment, the idea of a secret apartment, secret rooms. I think that somehow is almost an archetype, something we're very drawn to, but I'm not really sure why.
Well, I think I might know. I think for me, even writing it, this idea that there could be an architectural space that was able to shut out time and technology and all the things that have happened. I mean, it literally, like, you close the door and time stood still. And I think that's a very attractive thought for us in today's world, when we're constantly chasing to keep up with everything and there's never enough time. But what if time stopped? And what if you shut a door and everything was quiet and beautiful? It's a very attractive thought.
Something about thresholds, I guess. I'm thinking about how many children's books begin with a child opening a door and crossing a threshold into some other reality.
I love, like, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I'm thinking of that right away. Like, I love that idea of you opened up those doors and you stepped in and you fell into another world, or Alice in the Wonderland. It is a magical thought.
And the past is another world. So, you know, maybe that's the appeal. You open this door and you're magically transported back into the past. And, you know, sadly, there aren't those doors in real life. But I guess I think that's what books are. You know, I think that's what a novel is. You turn that page.
And you step into that world.
Yes. And the cover of a book is even shaped like a doorway. You know, it's like you walk into this magical other world for a while.
I agree.
So thanks for taking us there.
Well, thank you for having me.
Alison Richman has written 6 historical novels. We were talking about her latest, called The Velvet Hours.